Hi, everybody. I'm Anne Marie. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Anne Marie.
I have been sober since January 10th, 2005, and my home group is the Out to Lunch Bunch in Orange, Virginia. I, like so many people, were really nervous about coming up here and talking to you all, and as you can see, I have copious notes, and then I had an experience on Friday night that I'd like to share. A couple of weeks ago, one of my very good friends in AA passed away from this disease. And it hit me very hard. We came in at the same time. I did many 12-step calls at her house. And we were very, very close. And then I had to stop being friends with her. She moved away. And Friday night, I heard her give me a little nudge and say, "Call my sister." She had an identical twin sister. And I did that. I called her. I was present for her. It was just coincidence that that was the day that they were having the private memorial service for her. So her whole family was there. And I was able to talk to her sister about AA, about, you know, Jane, about what she went through and what a wonderful girl she was. And her sister thanked me and asked if we could get together. And I was so happy that I was able, for one of the few times in my life, to actually be present and be able to be helpful to somebody in a time of crisis. And the only way I could have done that is through Alcoholics Anonymous and all of you, because if it wasn't for each and every one of you, no matter how much time you have or if you're still experimenting, I learn, and my program is based on each one of you and what you contribute, and you all contribute something to my sobriety. So, I was born in, for a little background, on Long Island 63 years ago, and I did not grow up in a Beaver Cleaver family. I lived with, my grandparents lived with us. They were both raised in orphanages. My mother and father were both alcoholics. My father, and my mother was an only child, so, and my father was a wonderful man, but he was raised in a welfare situation. His father was alcoholic, his mother was mentally ill, and he was a World War II prisoner of war. So, all of the right juices were there. We drank in our house every single night. We lived in a neighborhood that that grew up after World War II, and everyone was damaged, or at least everybody that we hung out with was damaged. And I just never remember a night that alcohol was not involved, not only in my family, but in anybody that we popped into. It was one of those kind of neighborhoods where we would socialize and go back and forth and whatever. My father was an absolute wonderful, wonderful man. And he drank, I'm sure, a lot to forget and to dull. And he lived in a miserable situation. My grandparents who lived with us did not care for him. They felt that my mother married beneath her, and he was just such a fine, fine human being. He had, and I take after both of my parents in the way I handled alcohol. My father could drink copious amounts of alcohol, and I, as well, had a wooden leg. My mother became mean, nasty, vindictive, and she had one person that she took that out on, and that was me. And really, you know, it was not that I felt that I was unloved. I have made peace with the way I was raised, actually, even before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. These were broken people living in a broken world with shattered dreams. They did not have the idea of AA. I can remember being a kid and asking my mother, because there was a lot of alcohol, and I'll get to how that question came, but I was like, well, what exactly, Mom, is an alcoholic? Because there was a lot of liquor in my house. And Mom said, without missing a beat, alcoholics are those people who live at the Bowery. they are people who are unable to hold jobs and drink a lot. Everything that would exclude her or my father from being an alcoholic. It had nothing to do with getting drunk every night, not being able to live without a drink, none of those things. One quick little story about when I was a child. I was in either kindergarten or first grade, and we had show and tell, and we had to say what our moms did. And Anne-Marie said, well, my mom watches TV in her pajamas and drinks beer until my father comes home. And I'm not sure why social services was not dispatched to my house, but by the time I came home, my mom gave me the lecture, what happens in this house stays in this house. And I never forgot that lesson, I can assure you. It was very challenging growing up. I had to fill in for my mom a lot, and I learned a lot of things, some good, some very bad. But I used to have to, because when she would invite friends over, she could never fulfill her hostessing capabilities. One day I'm helping her make spaghetti, and everybody's waiting at the table, and I go to put the spaghetti in the water, and there were weevils in the spaghetti. And so I had to call Mom. You know, again, she was very quick on her feet, and she taught me how to get out of any situation, and she looked at me, and she goes, dear, that's oregano, if anybody asks. And, you know, you have to give her credit for being able to think like that, and I learned how to do that. I could talk myself out of anything, justify anything. I did not eat the spaghetti, however, that night. I felt very isolated as a kid. I did not fit in. I received a lot of emotional abuse. My mother would do things like in front of people would say, she's not my daughter, she's too ugly to be my daughter. Christmases, she would lock me in a room and tell me how I ruined her Christmas, how she had dedicated her whole year to wanting you know, all of these things that she didn't get for Christmas, and it was my, for some reason, it was my fault. I was the littlest one in the house, and that was the way it was. So I pretty much was a mess when I had to deal with people from the outside, with other children. I did not know how to relate to people. I was constantly worried about, is somebody going to be dinging me? You know, am I going to say something? Am I going to be in trouble, or what have you? So I had a grandfather who worked for the city of New York, and when he retired, a pharmacist who I guess he had done a few favors for gave him the pharmaceutical phenobarbital that came in, like, you know how tiny phenobarb is. Well, we had bottles of that for when he retired. And I can remember being a very small child, I mean, like, not even in school. And I used to hear my mom and my grandma and grandpa saying, I'm upset. I'm going to take a phenobarb. And so this little girl was upset a lot as a child. And I helped myself into self-medicating at that point. We also had something, and I don't know if anybody here is old enough to remember it, but something called Stokes cough syrup. Does anybody remember that? Mm-hmm. It used to be over the counter, and it had opium in it, and it had an opiate. And everybody in my family, except for my brother and I, smoked, and so there was a lot of coughing going on. And I made liberty with the Stokes cough medicine, and I was really very, very traumatized when they took that off the market. And when I started drinking was at a small child. I had a speech impediment. I couldn't say S's and TH's. So when my dad came home, first thing he had was a highball, and I would sit on his lap, and he'd have a sip, I'd have a sip, and then we'd start speech therapy. And I had a lot of sips, you know? And I loved it. I just loved it. I can remember one New Year's Eve, my parents had a party, and, you know, they were all in bed for a long time, and I was left to my own devices. And I ran around the room because everybody had left different drinks, you know, half can you imagine, things that were half drunk. And so I found this one thing, and I whacked it back, and it was quinine, you know, a gin and tonic. And I thought, oh, my God, I have been poisoned. And then I finished it. And it was downhill from there. When I grew up, drinking age was 18. Everybody in the crowd I hung out with started going to bars at about 15. My mom helped me get false ID, and, you know, they were real strict in those days. You know, you could have a library card and a baptismal certificate. Oh, yeah, you're 18. You're fine. She would tell me what to drink, you know, and she would have me drink all those really sweet things that, you know, I just could drink and drink and drink. And so things like slow gin fizzes and whatever. Don't remember my first drunk. Probably because I was buzzed most of my childhood. But I do remember my first real big hangover. And, you know, the parents thought it was funny. You know, there was nothing serious about it. There was no consequences for drinking. I mean, they did stupid things. I can remember my father coming home from his Christmas party and not being there in the morning, and nobody was upset. And somewhere about noon, he shows up, and he had fallen asleep in the train from Manhattan. And he was in the train graveyard, and it was locked up. Wow. You know, but Mom wasn't mad. She thought it was fun. You know, I mean, it was, you know, so there was not this sense of I'm doing something wrong. So I grew from this young girl, and I was, you know, I was chunky, and my mother didn't keep me very well, and you know, people kind of in grammar school made fun of me, and, you know, all of those sort of things. And then something happened in high school, and I lost a ton of weight, and I was real cute. You know, and I started working at Jones Beach, and I got a lot of attention. I got a lot of attention from boys. I went out, I think, when I was 15 or 16, and I came back to school, and I had dated 4 or 5 lifeguards, and let me tell you, I had status. And so it went in high school. Every chance I got, I drank. Every chance I got to drink, I got drunk. And it just didn't matter. I just was really, you know, on one hand, really enjoying myself. On the other hand, I just didn't fit in. You know, I didn't know how to handle my newfound success. I did terrible in school. They forced me to go to an all-girls Catholic school, and I was miserable. I'm sure now, in retrospect, I probably had attention deficit. I couldn't concentrate for more than 5 minutes. I never studied. I had a very high IQ. I came out of 110 graduating students. I came out at 107. you know, and my mother just was like, look at your IQ. Look at where you ended up. So there you have it. And probably the last 2 years in high school, I was so miserable. I used to dream every single night about running away. So when my mother found out that I was thinking about running away, what she did was she took me into Manhattan, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with the subways and how people live in those subways and what it's like, and she was there. Well, Anne-Marie, you want to run away? This is your life. And so I went back home, and I would just went from I'm going to run away tomorrow to 2 more years. I just have to sit this out for 2 more years. So I had many choices for college. As my act of teenage rebellion, rather than going to all of these wonderful schools, I went to the University of Miami. And I was terrified. I did not know how to relate to these people at all. I was excited. I wanted to be in a sorority. I wanted to belong. And so I was rushing for this sorority tri-delt. Everybody was blonde and blue eyes, and I knew this was where I was going to belong. So I got a date for homecoming, and I remember going to this party in some hotel, and then I remember waking up in the fraternity house and told that I was no longer being considered for a sorority. And that's pretty much it. I was devastated. I have absolutely no recall, thank God, of what happened. And much of my 20s and 30s were like that. I would really just black out and not remember anything. I also had this kind of personality where when I was good, I was really good. And then I had this wild side. And the only way I could release all this tension that I kept, because, you know, I had good jobs all my life. I did well at working, but there was this, I could feel that itch coming, you know. It was just sheer self-control, and then my behavior was legendary, colorful, flamboyant. And anyway, so, yeah, so, you know, I just can imagine what happened because, as you know, I mean, it had to have been pretty bad for at the University of Miami to be shunned from the frat society. So I came home after I flunked out, and Mom decided that I would go to a place called the Katherine Gibbs School. And the Katherine Gibbs School at that time was it was a secretarial school, finishing school, what have you. And so I went to Katherine Gibbs. And what I found out that there were some really nice women there who this was their goal. And then there was a bunch of screw-ups whose mothers decided they were going to Katherine Gibbs so that they could make a living. And, you know, it was funny because we all were able to just mesh with each other. Within a week, we were together. And we spent a lot of our lunch hours drinking beer downstairs from the school. And so I made it out of there. That was fine. And then I started getting some jobs, and my first job was I worked for an international music publishing company. And, you know, my work was great. My boss loved me. His wife loved me. I was there about 9 months, and they decided that they were having this big affair and that I needed to be there. And I think all was going well, but when people started to leave the party, I had this need to hug and kiss everybody. And so that led me to my second job, which was at the United Nations, a very fancy title. I was the liaison officer for the Consular Corps of the city of New York, and what I did was I fixed traffic tickets. And yeah. So things went well there. And then there was a big party and an affair. Many, many famous people. You know, the commissioner of my little office was Commissioner Loeb, and you know, I mean, it was just all these people. And well, some fellow realized I was a little tipsy, and so he, he was a reporter. And I loved to talk when I drank. And that led me to a new way of living. I quit that job and decided that what would fit me best was to become a barmaid. And, I just thought that was a very good idea. My parents were just ready to commit suicide. But anyway, so I became a barmaid, and the particular bar that I worked at was the hangout for a professional hockey team. And I'll leave you to imagine the rest of that story. And so I just went from job to job doing menial things, working till I could quit, moving home. I did a number of really, really stupid things. In retrospect, I think I was hoping to be killed. You know, I mean, I just didn't want to live. I would go by myself to a jazz club in Harlem. You know, I would go to the South Bronx when they were, like, torching it. I mean, I just did, I put myself in every possible bad situation I can. Only pulled over in a car once, and thank God I was looking pretty good that night, because the officer came, and I had kind of lost, well, I ended up on somebody's front lawn. And so the officer said, how did this happen? And, you know, from my mother's good training, I, in a second, said, I lost my power of concentration for a minute, officer, but I'm fine now. And and he said, well, if you can drive from point A to point B without weaving, I will let you go. So I did. I went like 3 or 4 miles an hour, and he let me go. And then, Mom was really trying to push me into doing something a little bit more productive with my life. So I found a career option. It was great for somebody like me. I went to work in the hospital. And, it's amazing anybody gets well in a hospital. So the first good news about working in the hospital, because I started out in the ER as a ward secretary, was tons of people come to work with hangovers. And, you know, at 7 a.m. in the ER, all of the oxygen stations were taken by us. So that was great. Became a nurse. Had a couple of relationships that probably would have been good, but as usual, my modus operandi was bad boys and booze, and so the good ones went by, and I canceled a wedding 2 days before the wedding, thrown out of the house. It was the usual. The house was a revolving door. And so then I started dating a physician, and that ended up being a big scandal because, his mother said, it's either her or me, and then she tried to kill herself, and Mom went out. And so then it was time for a new state, you know, that old geographic change. We have worn out New York, and let's go to Los Angeles. And, you know, and I'm telling you, Los Angeles was at times just a lot of fun. I hooked up with nurses and doctors just like me. Life was one big party after another. But I was starting to get really sad. Inside, I was dying. And always being a person of opposites, I decided that what I needed was God. So I joined the convent. And that didn't work out so well, you know. First of all, there was no men there, and that irritated me. And then, yes, I'm going to tell the story. So I was pretty unhappy. They tried to, you know, they really tried to nip my wings. And there was another gal there from Mexico. She had already been professed, but her order was dissolved, and she didn't speak a word of English, and I didn't speak a word of Spanish. But one thing I did have, I had money, and they didn't know it. And so I used to buy cocktails for one. Do you remember those cocktails for one? They were in little things, you know. Well, they may have been cocktails for one, but, you know, I'd buy them by, you know, the 24s, the dozens. And she and I used to go up, and where we were stationed was an old mansion in a not-so-good part of town. And so we would get up on the top balcony, and we would commiserate, she talking in Spanish and me in English, and and we'd be drinking and tossing the bottles over the porch. And then the next day, on one of these times when we really got a little out of hand, one of the other sisters came by and was talking to the Mother Superior, and she goes, "Mother, they're at it again. The homeless people are drinking outside of the convent. Look at all these bottles." And Mother knew and where that was coming from. So we left the convent, and I went back to being a nurse. And then, my drinking was really, really being really bad. You know, I would come home on Fridays, and I never saw the light of day until Monday morning. It was just unbelievable, you know, that year. And so I am becoming more and more desperate. And again, I believed that what I had to do was be a religious. So I went to the cloister. And I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed. So everything's going great, and I really loved it. You know, I mean, it was good. I do think, you know, probably in retrospect, there may have been a little bit of a vocation, but all of a sudden, you know, it's like I had to stay there a certain length of time. They wouldn't let you join unless you had this little trial period. And, you know, kind of like at the end of the trial period, I had noticed that at dinner time, now, you know, it's just like you see in the movies. You know, you don't talk during dinner, and you're seated like this. And I noticed that the prioress and the sub-prioress would get some wine. And I thought, well, I asked at lunch one time after lunch, you know, who's allowed to have the wine? And, anybody who wants it. I said, but nobody's going except for the superior. And she said, well, if you want one, you just go right ahead. So everybody else went up with, you know, the little wine glass, and I took my water goblet. And it was miserable because I couldn't get another glass. And I was supposed to stay for, you know, like another month or whatever, and I just couldn't handle it. I had to go. I had to go. I did it for maybe 3 days after I had that, and I had to beg somebody. It was over Thanksgiving weekend. Beg somebody to pick me up. And on the way home, the only place that was open was 7-Eleven, and I had to spend Thanksgiving night with two bottles of cold duck, and boy, let me tell you, that wasn't fun. So things weren't working out so well in California. I decided to move to Virginia. And again, I had some really, really good jobs. I worked at Georgetown. I was in charge of the same-day surgery there. But life was really kind of spiraling. I was having a hard time keeping things together. And this was my second time with law enforcement. I was coming from a holiday party. I was married at that time, but my husband didn't drink, can you imagine? So he didn't want to come with me. And I was stopped, and this was one of the worst days of my life because I knew I was going into the slammer. And I had to pull out the only card I had, and that was, you know, I'm a nurse at Georgetown. And the guy said to me, my next-door neighbor is at Georgetown. And I said, oh, really? Who is she? And it was the nursing supervisor for the big OR. And she said, I'm going to give her a call. Well, Gretchen was one miserable, vindictive woman, and she held that over my head. The guy let me go, but I never drank and drove again. I will say I learned with that. Not that I didn't drink again. I thought marriage would certainly kind of smooth things out. And then, I had this notion. I mean, my husband didn't pull any punches when we got married. He told me who he was, what he was doing. But, you know, in the true alcoholic fashion, he thinks that way now, but I can change him. And, I just couldn't change him. And, and he knew he couldn't control me. Before we got married, I said, there's two things I don't want you to ever throw up in my face. That I drink too much and that I'm not very tidy. And he swore he wouldn't do that. And for the most part, he's let me he shows his displeasure in other ways, but he doesn't bring it up to me. And but one of the ways that he did it was he had this crowd of people and they drank like I drank. I don't know why he fit in with this crowd because he really didn't drink that much, but and we had a wild time. I mean, it was great before I got married. The day after we got married, that was it. My husband sat in his chair and we did not party with anybody else. And I really, really started drinking a lot then. And then we so things weren't going so well. So we decided the way to make things work out was we were going to come to Culpeper and buy a farm. And certainly I wouldn't be able to drink if we had a farm because I would be busy with all of the farm chores. And, things just got uglier and uglier. I started working in a hospital around here, and I actually had to take calls, something I never had to do before. God must have looked out for me. I can remember one night I thought, oh, well, it's a little hospital. You're never going to get called in. I drank the whole evening. That was the one time that my husband told me that I better knock it off. I didn't get called in, thank God. But I thought, I just have no control of this at all. So I went to an AA meeting, and I just decided, no, I'm just not going to drink when I'm on call. And so I didn't drink when I was on call. What I did was I used to make fruit in big, big jars, and I would let that get to be alcohol. And I figured if anybody questioned me, I'd just say, well, I canned this fruit last summer, I don't know what happened. But that got me through the nights that I was on call. And And so it came to be that I had to take call for New Year's weekend, and it ended up being five days and six nights or something, because you got the eve and the other eve, and you got the weekend, and I thought I was going to really lose it, because I couldn't have anything to drink. And I made what I thought was a very sensible decision, and that was, I quit my job. And I opened my own business. So anyway, I've got to move on. So the business, I drank my business into the ground. I had a wonderful business. I had one in Culpeper. I had one in Orange. I made tons of money. I would go to the gift shows, and I would drink, and I would start in the morning, and I spent money, and I spent every penny I didn't have. I spent money like I had it. So 2004, things were not going well. I was not well. My mother was down here. She was dying. I don't think I ever slept. I passed out every single night, got up. I just could not stop drinking for anything. My health was going down. I had, at that time, a blood pressure of 210 over 110. I maintained that for about 3 years. I used to, you know, when I first got that and I went to the doctor, what I would do would be the next time, you know, when I'd have to go in to get it checked, I would stop drinking for a couple of days so that my blood pressure would be okay. And at the end, I couldn't stop drinking anymore. I just couldn't. So it just stayed where it was. And so I was in my shop, and I was screaming at a doctor on the phone. And all of a sudden, something happened. Something came over me, and it was like somebody was speaking to me, and it said, "And Anne Marie, everybody has problems, but not everybody has to drink over them." And I turned around, and there were two women in the corner praying for me. And I was just dumbfounded. I did not stop drinking that day. I had to wait until my mom passed away and whatever. My husband had no idea of how severe my physical problems were. I had GI bleeding, hypertension. Of course, my liver was shot. I can't remember everything else that was going on, but, you know, particularly, you know, I mean, my concern was all of the bleeding and that was going on for about 3 years. And I would start out in the morning saying, "I'm not going to drink," you know, and then it would start to clear up as the day would go. And then I'd be, "Okay, it's okay now. Now I can drink." And I'd start out the next day with that. So, New Year's Eve, I sat down with my husband and I told him I had to stop drinking. I didn't know how I was going to do it. And on January 10th, I went to my doctor, and I don't know where this came from, but I looked in there and I said, "I am an alcoholic." And she was like, "Well, I'm glad you finally realized that." And what are we going to do about it? So, you know, I told her all of the physical problems that I had. You don't need to hear the whole organ recital, although I used to love getting a lot of mileage out of that. I said to her, "I didn't want to get my liver enzymes drawn for a month." And so I had another episode of GI bleeding. They made me get my blood work done. And, well, gosh golly, those enzymes were off the scale. So thus began a journey to AA, and really what I consider the first part of my life, the beginning of my life. And God bless her. She went to her car that day and she said, Anne Marie, you will not make it unless you go to AA. She went out to her car, got a where and when, and told me I had to go. And so I said to her, well, how long do you think it'll be before my liver is better? And she said, 18 months. And I thought, well, I can do this for 18 months. So I went to my first meeting, of course, in Charlottesville, because I didn't want to know anybody or see anybody who knew me. And I did not have a good attitude about it. And then someone came up to me that first meeting and said, oh, I'm so glad you're back. I would recognize you anywhere. And I'm there. It is a cult. You know, and these people are nuts. So I went for a meeting a week for about a month or 2 months. And then my doctor said, you know, the things aren't really improving so very much here. How's your AA coming? And I said, oh, I go to Charlottesville once a week. And she was like, no, that's not going to help you. You need to go more often. And so she suggested that I go to a 7 a.m. meeting in Orange. And I thought, well, okay, nobody will see me. I don't know anybody. So, and, you know, when you're in those big meetings, you don't have to share. You know, nobody, you don't have to say you're new. So I go blasting in there at 7 a.m., and there's two guys and me. And I just was like, oh, shit. And they didn't give me any slack. And I had an answer for everything. I was there for a couple of times, and because then I was going to two meetings a week, whether I needed it or not. And they would just drum this stuff into me. And then we did these readings out of the book. And I can remember the first time I latched on to something in AA, and I was like, it was about amends, and I can share on this. So they come around to me, and because I didn't like to share, you know, I'd say one word, and that would be it. And I'm like, I am so glad this is in the book, I said, because there sure are a lot of people that owe me an amends. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to start making that list right now. How do you make them come back to me and say they're sorry? And they were like, no, that's not quite how it works. I was going to read this, but I'm not. So the fellow made me, this one fellow who had taken me under his wing, and he made me read the, you know, the doctor's, whatever it is, about acceptance, you know, that if there was something wrong with the world, it was me. And he would call periodically in the day and say, how many times have you read that? And, you know, I got sick of him calling, so I did what I was told, and I kept reading it and reading it and reading it. And I have to say, you know, that those two men were wonderful to me. I would not have made it in this program if they did not give of themselves, if they did not, they stayed with me every step of the way, you know, and they browbeated me into going to more meetings, and, you know, and every Friday they'd be, your job this week and is to get a sponsor. And I'd be, I don't need a sponsor. I have you guys. I don't need it. And then one day, you know, they had given me their numbers. I, of course, didn't need to call anybody. And it was, I guess, a Friday night, and I had lost their numbers, and I went into a tailspin. I couldn't wait to get, I knew they went to some stupid meeting in Madison, and so I ran to that meeting, got their numbers, and that was the beginning of life, really life-changing for me. I was 6 months in the program. They found a spot on my liver. I spent a week not knowing, you know, what it was. My father had died of liver cancer. My liver was not in great shape to begin with. I always wanted to not live. I didn't necessarily want to kill myself, but during that week, I had another really big spiritual experience, and by the end of the week, I I not only wanted to live, but I wanted to become part of this program, and I wanted to participate, and I wanted to get well, and I saw there was hope. And I was always a woman who thought about grandiosity, and, you know, like when I was a kid, I'd fantasize that I'd be on, you know, one of those talk shows, and I would be this or that. And at the end of the week, you know, that little voice in my heart said, yes, you do need to do something big. You need to stay sober today. And I'm like, that's it? And, you know, and God whispered back, and he said, that's it. And I got a sponsor. My sponsor was wonderful to me. She was an older woman. She was the same age as my mother who had passed away. She was everything to me that my mother was not. She taught me how to love. She taught me how to trust. I'm not sure how many specific things of AA that we did together, but she taught me all of the fruits of this program, and I loved her very much. We parted our ways for reasons that I'm not going to go into, but I was able to tell her. She passed away this year. I was able to tell her how much I loved her before she passed away. I went to her memorial service, and I carry her with me. Her son gave me one of her chips, and she's with me tonight. And again, I would not be where I am in AA if it was not for her love and understanding. She was exactly what I needed. God is so good to us. Somebody else might have needed a Gestapo person or whatever, but, I mean, she was just wonderful. I went through a period in AA where I didn't have a sponsor. I again felt this being drawn into my faith, and I was having a lot of difficulty reconciling the two, and I felt very uncomfortable about sharing. I felt like, you know, I wanted to share my faith, you know. I didn't want to share about AA. And of course, since I had a sponsor, but I wasn't using her, I just didn't have anybody really to talk this out with. And then one day, somebody in the rooms started preaching, and preaching their faith. And I had this... I was taken aback, and the first thing that came to my mind was, because she was saying things that I actually thought, but it was so inappropriate, and I thought, we are here for one purpose, to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And I realized there's a place for my faith, but it's not... You know, it's not in preaching or evangelizing in AA. And, you know, from that moment on, I was able to see the beauty of the spirituality of AA. I looked at the people around in those rooms, and I felt I just wasn't measuring up. I saw such beautiful things, people making 12-step calls, people taking care of each other, people handling other alcoholics in the middle of the night, and doing it with love and... you know, and it was an honor to serve, and I thought, I just have been behind the eight ball on this all along, you know, and I got a new sponsor who I didn't use for a long time, and then something happened this year. I'm in my ninth year, but I became very upset with someone, and my friend Monique took me out after the meeting and said, all right, Anne-Marie, what are you afraid of? And I was like, I hate fear. You know, I mean, especially, you know, I mean, perfect love, there is no fear, you know, the whole thing. And I was like, I am not afraid of anything. I said, this person is, you know. And so we went round and round. She said, well, work with me here. Tell me what's going on. And by the time we got to the bottom, it was... This person had disrespected me, and my whole childhood came up. And when I looked at how I did my my steps to begin with, I did them from a different perspective, and I realized that it was time to rework them. And that, you know, we may get a lot better in these programs, but we are damaged people. And no matter how hard we work, these things will keep coming up and revisit us. The damage is there. We can help to fix it, but we have to look at it, you know, and sometimes we have to look at the same stuff in a totally different way. And I'm in no rush to get through my steps. I have dealt with so much over these past couple of months. It is so freeing. It is so wonderful. I owe every good thing that I have in my life to AA. And I'm going to probably end here, but I just wanted to share one thing. I had a couple of things. And I learned these from other speakers. And the first thing that I learned that I think is important is the speaker said, learn how to fall in love with AA. And, you know, for me that was really news because I like to pick things apart. But I learned how to fall in love with AA. The second thing I had learned was that, you know, we often say in these rooms, take what you need and leave the rest. And the speaker said, take it all. You never know when you're going to need it. And I can't tell you how much that has helped me in my life. And the third thing is, and I'm going to end with this, is the speaker started her talk with this. And she said, thank you for being here today. Thank you. This is the most, she said, this is the most important day of my life. It's not my birthday. It's not a holiday. It's not my feast day. And she said, it's the most important day of my life because it's the only one I have. So thank you very much. Mm-hmm.